In this talk, I will deal with various relativistic effects that may be observed, that we may be observing in X-ray binaries, particularly in their high frequency variations of luminosity. That has been possible only since the launch of XTE, because XTE could go to very high frequencies. Actually, time resolution of XTE is not a problem at all for work on X-ray binaries. And starting in 96, actually late, was it 96? XTE observed wonderful things in about 20 different X-ray binaries. In this talk, I'll be dealing mostly about with the neutron star binaries, although some of it may have applications to black holes. So if you are interested, we can talk also about black holes. I may mention them along the way. So I'll give a brief overview of what we, since Lars asked me to do a little bit of overviewing of X-ray binary variability. The X-ray binaries, the neutron star X-ray binaries, come in two broad classes. One is atoll, and the so-called atoll source, and the other is Z. I'll not explain where these words come from. Just try to memorize this notation. The main difference is that Z sources can have luminosities up to Eddington or even exceeding Eddington. Then they really behave very violently, while the atoll sources reach a far lower luminosity, up to about 10% of the Eddington. So in both classes of sources, we have observed in the last few years quasi-periodic oscillations, primarily, the most interesting ones are probably the kilohertz QPOs. Let me show you what I mean by a QPO. Here is a picture of the power spectrum of one of the nicest sources for U728. It's an atoll source, so relatively low luminosity. But here in the power spectrum, so you all know what the power spectrum is. You simply Fourier transform the variations of the luminosity that you detect. And once you have obtained the power spectrum, you see several interesting features. This is XTE's claim to fame discovery of kilohertz QPOs. In this case, you see a pair of them. Very often you see pairs, sometimes you see only one of them. When you have pairs, that may imply several things, as I will be talking later about. In addition to these kilohertz QPOs, look, they are in the range of about 1,000 hertz. There are also lower frequency QPOs. In this particular case, they're somewhere between 30 and 60 hertz, or somewhat bigger than that. One thing to notice is that they are much broader than the kilohertz QPOs. I mean, the Q factor, which is a ratio of the frequency to the width of the QPO, is much lower than those of kilohertz QPOs. Now, those kilohertz QPOs, those pairs that you saw, they vary in time. And they are always positively correlated with the count rates. So the bigger the flux, the higher the frequency of these kilohertz QPOs is. Here you see plotted several sources in one figure. The most powerful one, and probably the one with the best observations, is COX-1, which is here given with these axes, crosses or whatever. Then you see other ones, but the thing to notice, and I got a confirmation of Mikhail a few months ago. I extracted it from him, actually, that The most interesting thing is that these are all single track correlations. That is, if, for instance, let's speak about SCOREX1, you have observed a point right here, and then it may evolve, it may go to a higher luminosity and therefore higher frequency, but then when it returns to the frequency nu1 of the lower kilohertz QPO, then the delta nu, the difference between the two kilohertz QPOs, will be as it was when it was previous at that point. That's so the track is essentially the property of the source. It doesn't walk around. It always has to fall on the track. And there has not been observed any violation of this rule, anything that is inconsistent with it. The fourth frequency here that I mentioned in this transparency is the burst oscillation, which should occur at the spin frequency. What's happening? Once the enough nuclear fuel accumulates on the surface of a neutron star, there occurs a flash, and presumably initially this flash starts from a single spot, and then, well, or two spots. In any case, this spot that is rotating with the star will produce a very sharp signal at the spin frequency. Well, that's an interpretation, but seems a solid one. So you see, these QPOs are very sharp. I mean, notice this is between 360 and 365 hertz. It's again 4U728. This is just the behavior of the flux during the burst. It has fast rise and then an exponential decay. Now, YGR. What does GR have to do with all this? Well, the kilohertz QPO frequencies are in the range which is comparable to the frequencies of orbits, of relativistic orbits in the immediate vicinity of the neutron stars. So I just give here fiducial value for one solar mass. A neutron star, I mean higher mass neutron stars will of course have lower frequency, which will be then close to the observed frequencies in kilohertz QPOs. Then if you look at the ratios of sizes, I mean, that is the ratio of the neutron star size to the Schwarzschild radius, it's close to one. It's, I mean, bigger than two, but it is still, those objects are very compact, so any kinds of motions in their vicinity will be highly relativistic. That, for instance, has to do, I mean, has bears upon what signal you observe from the type 1 bursts from those single spots, and then you can use that to put some limits on the size of the star.
R ISCO was 6N, is that what it was?
Sorry?
R ISCO?
ISCO, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's Schwarzschild. I just took one example. Well, for neutron stars, they never, they never approach anything like, you know, a curve metric with a fast rotation. I mean, their J's are 0.2 at most, something like that. Okay, so following this hint of, you know, highly relativistic behavior around neutron stars, there have been developed several models that do try to take advantage of various features of relativity. So you've probably heard about sonic point beat frequency model, in which the upper kilohertz QPO is identified with a Kepler frequency at the inner edge of the accretion disk. I'm not going into detail, I'll just give you some basic numbers and relations. While the lower kilohertz QPO is identified with the beat between the Kepler frequency and the spin frequency of the neutron star. And then, well, the low frequency QPO is then attempted to be explained by magnetospheric beat So with the spin at the boundary of the magnetosphere. But there is an alternative model proposed by first by Stalin Vietnam, and they started all this fuss about lens steering in 98, actually 97. Sometimes they identified the low frequency QPO with some kind of motion induced by lens steering precession, or rather nodal precession. I'll explain in a moment what's the difference. There is another set of models which goes all the way to general relativity and tries to explain all the frequencies in terms of orbital frequencies, I mean all the observed frequencies in terms of orbital frequencies of somehow defined a set of orbits, so that in all those models, really, the Epicurus QPO is identified with the Kepler, then the lower with absidal precession. That's a relativistic effect. You have, when you have a slightly eccentric or really eccentric orbit, it's what do you call it? Periastron, yes. Periastron will precess. At the frequency, which is the difference between the Kepler frequency and the radial epicycle frequency. And then the low frequency is again identified with nodal precession or twice the nodal precession. Now, how do you define the family of orbits? You cannot have just any kinds of orbits. Remember, those are all single tracks. So it has to be a one parameter family of orbit in any case.
Aren't you representing circular in these days?
Well, okay. I'll come to that. We would like them to be circular. You would like them to be somewhere. Yes, exactly. Somewhere around the inner edge of the disk, and then maybe you can have a free orbital motion or something coming close to it if you can decouple from the disk. That's a complicated story. The main thing here is that this model was motivated really by the fact observed very early in XT observations that delta nu, the difference between the upper and lower kilohertz QPO, was declining. You remember what I showed just minutes ago here. Okay. You see that in all these sources. Okay, this is a special case. It's flat here, but then sharply drops at 728, and you see other sources. So delta nu is really not constant, which makes problems for the simple version of the beat frequency model, where delta nu should be something like spin frequency, and that should be constant. Well, in my talk, the scene that will be common to all its parts, all its components, will be the lens steering precession. So let me just briefly explain what it is. If you have an orbit, let's think of a circular orbit, which is somewhat inclined relative to the equatorial plane of the neutron star or black hole. This orbit will, the plane of the orbit itself will precess. So the line of the nodes will rotate around the star. So, and it will rotate, and this is a relativistic effect, general relativistic effect. Here I'm just writing the weak field limit of it. The lens steering frequency is proportional to the angular momentum of the central star. And it has this sharp fall-off, r cubed, so it's a strongly radial-dependent effect. Now, in reality, this nice relativistic effect is always contaminated with a non-relativistic quadruple precession. It's simply the star, because it rotates, has to be deformed, has to be oblate. And then in this case, as I define it here, Q is positive. So the nodal precession frequency will be always lower than just the lens steering by this amount here, which actually has a rather similar dependence on R. I mean, this is 3, and here we have 7/2. But in the case of neutron stars, now, of course, it depends on the equation of state. for very puffed up stars, I mean with a stiff equation of state, then the formation of star due to rotation will be bigger, and this effect will be much stronger. For let's say medium stiffness equation of states, this lens theorem really dominates by something like a factor of 10 near in the vicinity of the neutron star.
Is this a dependent source of information?
Sorry?
Is there an independent source of information for how deformed the object would be? I mean, intrinsic information.
Well, the only thing we have is presumably the spin frequency from the Bose oscillation, and then we can play with the various equations of state. We don't have any other information about the deformation. I mean, I'll be talking about it in some detail. So, I mean, this is for a free orbit. The story for an accretion disk is more complicated. I'll come to that. So here is the plan for my talk. I will first discuss gravitomagnetic disk modes because it is non-trivial that this null precession will produce a relevant effect in accretion disks because they are strongly viscous, and this kind of precession that is strong functional R would be due to viscous friction. Such differential precession would be strongly damped. I mean, you would expect that. Then, as it turns out, there are a set of weakly damped modes that are concentrated near the inner edge of the disk. I'll show in some detail how you obtain them. However, I mean, we should, in the end, compare whatever frequencies we get with observations. It turns out, and I will also explain that, that if you do assume that the higher Hilkert's QPL is occurring at the Kepler, then with the given information about neutron stars, like their spins, you don't have enough angular momentum to drive fast enough a lens steering precession to account for the low frequency QPL frequencies. After that, but that doesn't mean that the modes that I will describe will never be detected. They may be somewhere at lower frequencies than those frequencies of the low frequency QPOs. Then I will discuss the orbital precession model, the nice and pure relativity model, which is attractive because it's pure relativity, although it has big problems with physics. And I will describe how the frequencies obtained from that model match the observed frequencies. And then in the end, I will discuss at what at what frequencies would actually this orbital precession model produce modulation, whether it is really the Kepler and the absolute precession or maybe some other frequencies. Now, disks. When you talk about viscous disks, the important fact to remember is that back in the 70s, Bardeen and Patterson found that within something like 100 gravitational radii, a disk should be confined to the equatorial plane of the star, whether neutron star or black hole. It's a combined effect of, as I said, strong dependence of null precession rate on the radius, and on one hand, and on the other hand, viscosity of the disk. There was some work, I mean, fair amount of work in the meantime. People, these smudges. People found the modes that corresponded to this lens steering precession of the inner disk, but they were found in non-viscous disks, so you know, pure ideal hydro. In some cases, viscosity was included a posteriori, but I mean, I don't have the time to elaborate. You have to worry about boundary conditions. and I don't think they were taken into account properly. So I took upon myself the task of finding the modes of viscous disks, and to really explore whatever warping and whatever frequencies of the modes you can come up with. Just a little bit of theory. Essentially, you have to solve an equation that describes a disk as that assumes a disk is a set of circular orbits that rings actually. On each ring, the dominant motion of the gas is azimuthal, Kepler motion. However, you also have viscous coupling among the rings. So this equation, L is the local direction of the normal to the ring's plane. So L is a function of radius. Omega is the local azimuthal frequency. And then sigma is the density, surface density, R is the radius. So the thing to notice here, this is just dr of the current, and then d by dt of the angular momentum density. And then you have viscous torques that couple the rings. Here I included three torques. This all approach to viscous warping was added by Pringle in collaboration with Popolozzi. So Pringle introduced this radiation torque that is from the central source. You assume you have radiation hitting various parts of the disk if it is warped. And then, I will not explain that in detail, this radiation torque feeds angular momentum into outer portions of the disk, and that may cause warping instability. Here is our Lanz-Terrain torque. This is radiation, this is Lanz-Terrain, sorry. Yes, of course. R cube dependence has to be there. So this is the quadrupole moment torque, which I didn't really include. The main point here is really to notice the gravitational the gravitomagnetic torque. I don't know if I should describe. I mean, not sure the details. This is just some basic assumptions about the structure of this. F naught is the parameter, I think, introduced by Shakur and Sonnier originally. If F naught is equal to 1, you're assuming there is the viscous stress at the boundary of the disk at the inner edge vanishes. Sorry, the other way around. If F naught is equal to 0, it vanishes. No, so my goodness. If F naught is equal to 1, it vanishes. However, I mean, we now know from simulations that at the inner edge, the viscous torque really never vanishes completely. So F naught should be somewhere between 0 and 1. And this is a minor detail. Then I assume the standard Shakur-Sinyaev alpha prescription, where the viscous stress is proportional to pressure. And then you can write the main variable that you are solving for, W, which is a function of R and T. W is simply the projection of the vector orthogonal to the ring onto the equatorial plane. So the bigger the W, the more inclined the ring is. I hope it's clear. So
am I right in thinking that you're assuming a maximal viscous torque at the inner edge? Is that F not equal to 0?
If F naught is equal zero, then yeah. I mean, you essentially assume that.
And that is what you're assuming.
Where does it say? Yeah, I mean, at the beginning. Later on, I will describe what changes are introduced by, but. As you approach F naught equal 1, then everything is singular because Shakur-Sinyaev discussed that singularity at the inner edge. But you can get really well, I'll come to that later. You can get really close to one and nothing really changes. Now, by Bill Peterson, MOTES, as found originally in the 70s, it was really only the zero order mode. So, I mean, just look at the equation, what it looks like. The main thing to notice is that there are small radii. This thing is really big. So this exponent, forget about the I, forget about the complex part. This exponent is very small. Okay, a small radii. So within something like the Bedin-Peterson distance scale, which is about 100 rotation radii, the disk is flat. Now,
I'm sorry, I'm confused about another. But you're also only considering axisymmetric modes here. Is that correct?
Axisymmetric modes?
Yeah.
No.
From the form of your eigenfunction on the previous transparency, that's what looked.
No, I each ring has its own tilt and twist.
Okay.
So then this should correspond to something like m equal 1 modes, if you would, if you do more general disk oscillations. So then starting from this zero order mode, you find low frequency gravitational gravitomagnetic modes which are strongly damped. And their sigmas, their damping rates, are always bigger than about 10 times the frequencies. If radiation is included, it doesn't really affect these gravitational, gravitomagnetic modes, because the radiation torque really can work at large distances only, and then this gravitomagnetic Bedin-Peterson effect occurs at low radii. So there is very little overlap between those two length scales. So once you have, once you go to high order modes, let me show you the spectrum. Here. So, Bedin-Peterson zero order mode will be something in the minus infinity. This is logarithmic scale. You go up in the number, in the mode number, and the Q factors drop, and then drop really precipitously. At this point, the frequency stops increasing. So only at very low frequencies. I normalize this frequency with the gravitomagnetic frequency at the inner edge of the disk. On at very low frequencies, the radiation torque has any effect. So here, you're purely in the realm of gravitomagnetic modes, pure gravitomagnetic. I want to show you a movie. This will work. Oh, actually, it will take some time to warm up. In the meantime, I can just keep talking. So, however, that's not the whole story. At high frequencies, you find, oh, it does. So we can go ahead. No signal. Hello?
Did it work before?
Yeah.
What was occurring on you keep talking on the apparatus.
Well, okay.
it was showing the monitor.
Yes. Well, I will just check it a few minutes before the talk. Anyway, we can live without it. Here is just to make it blank. At high frequencies, there is another family of modes that stretch almost all the way to the frequency of the.
Keep talking.
Well, you have to press this button here. No, this one. Just something you have detached.
So Charles, let me ask a question.
Yeah.
So there's one oscillation you didn't mention, which is the 6 hertz oscillation.
Oh, that, 6 hertz.
Which is also quite prevalent in many of these sources. Is that now no longer?
I don't have a story for it here. It's no, on the other hand, you know, that one is too low for last hearing. So, well. I think we can skip it.
Excuse me, I'm in the last question. One is plotted on the y-axis.
Okay, on the y-axis, on the x-axis, I'm plotting the frequency, and it's normalized to the gravitomagnetic frequency at the inner edge of the disk. And on the vertical, I'm plotting the q value, which is frequency of the node divided by its damping rate. So then when you get to high frequency modes, notice that this Q starts going up again. And then it can reach fairly high values. Now these modes, okay, I'll be showing pictures anyway. So these modes at the inner edge of the disk, here I'm going now backward. That is, m equal 1 will be the highest frequency mode, and m equal, here in this case, can I do this? Yeah. Okay, so this is m equal 14. Well, I want you to see the, yeah, like this. So this is the inner edge of the disk here, right? It affects only a very small, a very narrow annulus close to the inner edge of the disk. And then if you go to lower modes, m equal, 10, 5, and so on, here is the mode equal of number 2. So,
by the way, why is it called gravitomagnetic? Where is the magnetic?
Oh, yeah. Okay, it's a name. Gravitomagnetic is, if you write the expression in the weak field limit, it has direct analogy with the magnetic force, because it's J cross the moment of angular moment of the.
It was a real magnetic.
Yeah. It's pure gravitational effect.
It's just because it depends on the motion of the mass.
Yeah.
The motion of the mass itself.
Yeah. Actually, you can write it in terms of vector potential and then derive a force, which is like magnetic force.
Drazza, can I? I'm sorry to keep on bugging you, but can I understand something about the equilibrium about which you're? Is this an accretion disk?
Yeah.
That is, there is mass inflow.
There is mass inflow.
Through the inner edge.
Yeah, it's important.
You can still get modes that are highly confined to the ISCO.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Does it depend on alpha in any way?
Sorry?
This depends on your viscous torque.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. For very high alphas. I mean, viscosity is really strong. And here I assume viscosity is only 0.1. Alpha 0.1. So this is m equal 2 mode, and then this is why I wanted to show you the movie, because it you can see it much more clearly. This is the fault. This is the part of the disk affected by m equal 1 mode. So you see, it's a very narrow region near the inner edge of the disk, and if you would see the entire thing, this sort of folding up would turn into warping up would turn into warping down on this side. So it's just a single single corrugation.
How come the article 14 case didn't show more radial nodes?
Well, it does. It's a spiral structure. I showed only sort of a cake slice of it.
If 45 degrees.
Yes, if you would see all of it, you would see spiral structure. Okay. Now, so the thing to keep in mind about these modes, as I said, you know, they come really, M equal 1 comes really close to the length standard precession of the inner disk. Now, what is good about these high frequency modes is that they are, I mean, especially M equal 1, it is likely to be excited by an external torque because it has a simple shape. If you have, like Jim asked me, if you have a highly wound mode in a narrow annulus, then its shape is so complex that if you apply any external torque, like magnetic field, different pieces of the mode, I mean the torques in different pieces would probably cancel each other. For M equal 1, it's simple, and if you would apply, as I said, some external magnetic field, or maybe figured out how the internal turbulence in a disk would couple with the warp, then it could be excited. I mean, this is a story that I still have to explore. The main thing to remember is that these are all damped. I mean, they are weakly damped, but they are damped. So something has to excite these modes. They are not growing in growing instabilities. Also, this mode.
Your computer is having problems.
Aha. Uh-huh, okay. At least we know where we are. They are also, I mean, M equal 1 is more likely to be observable than the other modes. One thing, the basic thing you can notice is because it has two nodal points, and those nodal points, the viscous stresses are the highest, so the viscous heating would be the highest. So then you would expect the signal actually to be occurring at twice the nodal precession frequency, which may help with some in some cases. In the case of neutron stars, there is also a possibility of accretion onto modulation accretion onto the neutron star. You are fundamentally changing the shape of the inner disk, and then from different parts of the mode, then the accretion rate should be enhanced or somehow reduced. So this is another possibility of flux modulation. Now I'm coming to what Omar asked. If this F naught parameter is less than 0.8, you know, I started from zero, and if you go all the way to somewhere 0.8, then nothing fundamentally changes. Then the things become somewhat nasty. I don't have those plots. As you come to somewhere F naught of 0.9, this M equal 1 mode starts spreading out. It is not so narrowly confined to the energy of disk. You may say, because it is spreading out, it may actually produce observable effect more likely. But then it is more highly damped. At F not equal 0.9, I mean for the relevant parameter, I'm assuming 2 solar mass, Newton star, and so on. At F not equal 0.9, the damping rate is something like only 10 times smaller than the frequency. For F not equal 0, it is 50 times.
So Peter writes again, so I didn't get the sign right on F. If it's the torque at the inner edge of the accretion disk. So F of 0 is what?
No. It's actually 1 minus F naught would be the torque at the inner edge of the disk.
So F is 1, there is no torque at the inner edge.
Okay,
of the
but here I'm talking about really hard.
That's correct, Lars. And if F is zero, there is a full torque of the air.
Yeah.
What I'm concerned about is the confinement. I mean, this is actually opposite to what I would naively expect this behavior that you're finding. So can I understand exactly what boundary condition you apply at the inner edge on these modes?
This is the boundary condition of disk structure is given by this F naught. However, there is another boundary condition. Good that you reminded me, which is the boundary condition on the vertical torque. So you have this torque in the equatorial plane. However, there could be another torque that tries to displace the disk from the equatorial plane. Now, I strictly assume that torque to be zero.
Okay,
then that in mathematical terms, that means that dW by dr is zero, because this torque would be proportional to this derivative. So if you don't assume that, you may be feeding angular momentum by some external torque which is in your boundary conditions, and you know, then you can get any kind of frequency you like. Here, at least I know what I'm doing. Here, these are just... Oh, okay. So can we go ahead? Oh, you have to download it again.
But if you're going to argue that the frequencies that you're getting are not the observable frequencies, then surely you must question whether those boundary conditions are the appropriate boundary conditions for reality.
Let's go. Can you go? Can you scroll up? Yeah, low resolution quick time, I think. It will take some time to download, so we can, in the meantime, keep on. However, you know, if you ask me...
Particularly if you're invoking magnetic fields to exert stresses across the disk and all of that stuff.
Look, in order to excite these modes, I need the relatively weak magnetic fields. However, if you're asking me to impose a torque on the inner boundary that will just shift the frequency up to a nice frequency that is comparable to the observations, then it's not really just Lens steering effect or in an old precession, it is really that plus something else.
I understand that, but if your results are sensitive to the assumptions that you're making there, then I would argue...
Well, the relation is simple. The relation is simple. I mean, the derivative you impose on the inner boundary is proportional to the outside torque. So if you shift by some amount of frequency, that will be really how much torque you are adding to the line steering torque. We can see it. Okay, good. So this is what I wanted to show you. Now let's play. This is starting from one of the very low frequency modes. If you remember, they are in the left branch. So I'll let it play and you will see what happens. Then we will approach the center. So this mode is low frequency and affects the disk everywhere except... Now we are coming closer and closer. It has many spiral corrugations. Now, remember, I said this is low frequency mode. So what do you see in the center? It's flat. So you're still in the Bardeen-Peterson Pedersen regime, where the inner, about 100 gravitational radii have to be flat. Okay? Then you approach the inner edge of the disk, and that will be the next move if we can download it. I mean, this one, yeah. It's much shorter. Oh, it's there. Great. So then you're looking really at the inner portion of the disk, and this is the M equal 1 mode that I talked about a few minutes ago. So, I mean, it just moves around. It processes here. You will see a blow up of a small sector.
Your inner boundary is at 6M. So if you Do you think it would be much different if it's running into the star?
Into the star? Yeah. Well, that's then quite different.
Right, so this is all presuming that...
Well, you know what?
Inside the last table.
With all the neutron stars, I mean, that have dealt with reasonable equation state, ISCO is bigger than the star. So we are done. Thank you very much.
So the inner edge of the disk always in your idea is the last table orbit?
It can be anywhere, but here I assume this is the last table orbit. Okay. Okay, now I'm yeah, we're done with the movies. So thank you. What was it? So this is what I was talking about, observations. What's the time?
You got 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. Observations, well, as I said, with realistic moments of inertia, it's really hard to get these null perception frequency up to what's observed. So even if you go to factor of 2, that is if you go to the second harmonic, so actually, you know, the low frequency QP would be occurring at the second harmonic of the normal precession frequency.
Can I take a comment? I mean, the thing, you know, when you're doing the seismology without an excitation mechanism, that's fine.
Yeah.
Game play. Of course, the numerology has to work first before you get worried about whether you excite the modes.
Yeah.
So the thing that I think for many people is striking about the lens Turing is it predicted that the lens Turing go like a Kepler squared.
Yeah.
And that scaling has been observed. Right. Last I looked, they plot lens Turing versus the frequency you claim. The plot is here. Okay. Okay. So okay. It's changed. That's the plot.
Okay. This is one example that I wanted to show. Okay. It's 1728. We know it's spent from the burst oscillation. And then this is done in a full relativistic space-time. So these are the frequencies that have been observed. If you want to stick to the low branch, now, you know what I'm doing here? I'm taking the sine point bit frequency model. And you know, if you look at the most recent paper they had some fit for the kilohertz QPOs. I'm simply taking their mass that they give me from their fit, and I have no freedom. I have the spin, I have the mass, I'm using the UU equation of state, medium stiffness, and it passes here. Is it close? Is it far? The slope doesn't quite correspond to the observed slope. I think the observed slope is higher. You have to keep in mind that the effect of near the small radii, the effect of the quadruple precession is strong, so it makes slope flatter.
This is 1.74.
Yeah, 1.74.
Is
there any
independent notion of what the mass is?
Okay, as I took this from the paper by Miller and Lamb. They fit. They got the mass that corresponds best to the kilohertz QPOs. I mean, this is I did a couple of days ago only. So I take that mass that it's their favorite, and then I simply plot twice the normal precession frequency, and I get rather close to this lower branch. But you know, you should bear in mind that the slope is really not 2.
Okay, that's what I wanted to say. So
okay.
For a while, it looked good.
It's, yeah, yeah.
As usual, always off.
So as I said, you know, the observations don't quite correspond to. But this is tantalizing. It's why would it be so close? You know, you have to ask that
question. Let me get an intelligent conclusion.
Yeah.
The gravitometric.
Gravitomagnetic.
Gravitomagnetic. Waves that you consider, are they helpful in the end for you to make peace with phenomenology or not?
To make what, sorry?
To make peace with phenomenology.
Yeah. Well, in the frequencies you get close, I mean twice the normal precession, you get close in the case of atoll sources. For the Z sources, they have much higher frequencies of those low frequency QPOs. And you don't even get close. In the case of atoll sources, you get close, but you're not quite there. Maybe if you fiddle with some external torque, you can get to the frequencies you need.
So at the moment, if there's only a continuous stream.
Yeah, yeah. It's not good.
Have such waves been located in any other context? They are fascinating.
Yeah. Well, they are nice.
The problem
is even if they are there, if you know, in a full discussion on a Christian disk, these modes will survive. That's not a trivial question. I mean, I'm having a toy model of the disk. If the modes survive, then the question is what excites them. Will they ever be excited? And even if they are excited, will they produce modulation of X-ray flux? So.
Exactly how far off these frequencies are from the observations.
I mean, well,
you see it.
Your model frequencies, not the five paper by Miller and Lab. Okay, you remember. Oh, sorry. M equal one modes is at the frequency of the inner edge of the disk. If the inner edge of the disk moves in and out, then the frequencies will move in and out.
Those are your curves then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So here I took for three equations, take the solid one is the UU, and then the other ones have some different equations. Like, for instance, for the stiff one, you have really flat profile. But yeah, so this is how close you get.
That's not too bad.
It's not too bad.
That's what everyone.
When you're bigger and fierce.
But you know, I'm not fitting anything. I'm just plotting.
That's the point. You have no free parameters. That's the beauty of the concept.
Sidebands. Well, I'll cut out a portion of my talk. The sidebands. You probably heard about them. That is, Janker and his collaborators observed sidebands to the lower of the kilohertz QPOs, and then. Someone proposed that the difference between the sideband frequency and the new one, the lower kilohertz QPO, should be something like Lance steering. It's in the right range, is it? Well, again, I want to be honest. The question is how you would ever produce a signal at a sideband with the Lance steering precession. I didn't find any natural way. You have to really assume unrealistic things. I will not go into detail. But let's look at the frequencies. Here I plot twice the normal precession as a function of the Kepler frequency. This is the UU equation of state. These are fully relativistic orbits, circular orbits. So this is the sideband separation from the lower kilohertz QPO. It's far above for the U equation state. For the L equation state, again, the one I dare not speak of in the presence of nuclear physicists, it's stiff, it gives you a high angle of momentum, it does get you somewhat rather closer to the observed value, but you're not quite there. So the normal precession interpretation of this offset of the sideband really doesn't work.
The truncation is
at the ISCO, in the most stable circular orbit, or actually in the L equation state, in some cases, it's truncation at the surface of the star, because those stiff equation state stars are really large, 15, 16 kilometers.
But now you have to take sidebands, you have to assume that the lower frequencies become
less
in order to get this business.
No. At the same time, it was observed higher frequency kilohertz QPO. Right? So at the same time, there was, you remember. Yes, right. But I do have information. If I say this is Kepler, then this delta nu, then I can compare that with the normal precession frequency, actually twice the normal precession frequency.
Yeah,
I think the other way to say it is, if you presume the lower one is Kepler, then the problem's even worse.
In that case, it's even worse.
It looks like the sign that's unassociated is the lower and not the upper.
Well, that makes really problems for figuring out how you modulate. How do you produce sideband to the lower kilohertz QPO? Actually, it would be difficult even with the higher kilohertz QPO. I have no time to go into detail. So, 5 minutes, 5 seconds.
5 seconds.
Well, I'm sorry. Ben, you know what? There was, I also wanted to say something about the orbital models for kilohertz QPOs. I said they have big problems with physics, particularly because you cannot get good correlations with circular orbits. Let me show you an example. Okay, if you stick to circular orbits, this is what you get. I mean, these are Fourier relativistic orbits around neutron stars, or for play, I also took an example of a black hole. So the slopes are much steeper. SCOREX1 has a relatively flat slope, and with circular orbits, you cannot get such flat slopes. The only way to get a flat slope is to get very high angular to take a very high angular momentum, but then you have to increase the mass. Here I took, as I said, for play, you have to take a very high mass for the black hole. That is, you know, for neutron stars it's impossible to do it. With the black holes you can go. You can do it with a high mass black hole, which of course wasn't proved, and SCOREX1 is a black hole. But
the black in the sense that there is no neutron star equation and state that you can hook up to get spent in the versus neutron.
Yeah.
It's simply
a matter of maximum mass. There is no equation of state or neutron star that gives a greater mass than 3. Am I right? Okay, 3 is a really big number. And then to get the right slope, I have to go to really high masses.
Provided you assume this particular model.
Well, I take circular orbits only. Here I'm talking about the other orbital model where Kepler is new to a new one is the periastron. Yeah, starting the entry, right. So circular or even near circular orbits don't work at all. You have to go to highly eccentric orbits. And actually, as you look at various sources, you have to go to eccentricities, actually ratio of aperson to periastron of 3 or 4. Now, how can you ever have such highly eccentric orbits? There are problems with fluid dynamics. What makes these blobs get onto such orbits, what puts them, and then at any given time you can have only a certain class of orbits, right? With a given periastron and given aperson, because otherwise you would be observing not a QPO, you would have a variability over a broad range of frequencies. So there are strict constraints frequency-wise that force you to adopt highly eccentric orbits. So, yeah, then I just show you this conclusion for the orbital models. Eccentric orbits give reasonably good correlations for kilohertz QPOs, somewhat poor match to low frequencies. Oh, there's a rich story here. I don't have time. Modulation actually does not occur at nuk and nuk minus nu r as proposed. Actually, the strongest modulation, I'm talking about clumps that fly on those eccentric orbits, the strongest modulation occur at these frequencies, nuk plus nu r, nuk plus 2 nu r, and nu r. Remember, in this business, I didn't point out that in this setup, nu r is the only real frequency. The only periodicity in the motion is the radial, the periodicity of the radial motion. All other frequencies are only approximate. that is, for instance, Kepler frequency, because the orbits are not closed, right? They are chaotic orbits, I mean, with only two integrals of motion. So then you, because you have heliocentric orbits, you have problems with fluid dynamics. Then these clumps have to be really very tiny in order not to be disrupted by tidal forces. So, you know, the size of the clump divided by the orbital, the size of the orbit is 110 to the minus 3, which then forces you to have extremely high density contrasts, something like 10 to the 5. So density in the clump should be at least 10 to the 5 times bigger than the density of the gas in the environment. It's hard to think how you ever can, you know, physically account for such a model. I mean, the main motivation was, of course, if I got really good frequency correlations, I didn't have time to explain that. If I got really good frequency correlations, then I would, you know, maybe try to think harder about fluid dynamics and all the apparent problems. And then, you know, it would be a very nice model, but it doesn't work because, you know, you really have to use heliocentric orbits. Okay, thank you. Sorry to make it so long. Questions?
What's the magnetic field strength you need to have towards the dominant accepting the range?
That's a good question. I forgot the number. I think it's on the order of what would be the frequency? What would be the magnetic frequency for an inner ring of a plasma forced by the magnetic field? You can figure that out. It must be very simple. And then simply compare it with the frequency of the magnetic. See, it, you need something like on the order of 10 hertz.
Right.
Could you do it?
Yeah.
After a
call. I was just asking for you to comment publicly and on record whether trapped hydrodynamic modes, like Wagner and Novak, have anything to do with any of this stuff.
Okay, those are... there needs to be done extra work on this, and, you know, serious work. Essentially, the work was started by Kato on disk seismology, and then they solved for modes that are ideal fluid modes. So the coupling between various parts of fluids was by pressure.
Right. No, you commented on that.
So this coupling assumes only viscous coupling. I mean, my modes assume only viscous. You have to really do both things together, until something like that is done. I cannot say, you know, where the matching would occur. Okay? Because, you know, in disks, both pressure and viscosity are important. And you have to do it from the outset. It doesn't really suffice to solve for fluid dynamical modes, and then sort of estimate the damping rate based on the shear and the estimate of the viscosity. So you have to do both things. Well, I hope I'll do it sometime in the future.
The similar question, your comments about there was a paper by Titarchuk and Koshevich called this Coriolis effects which lead to splitting frequencies.
I don't have comments right now. Actually, you know, I've been preparing to read that paper for a while. So maybe if you wait until Friday, we can have a detailed discussion. I did try to read, and I didn't understand. So I should try harder, I guess.
Yeah, no, we better let you work.
Thank you.